Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. I hope I'm getting through to you today because it's been pretty hectic here on my end of the world. I've, in one day, had the powers that be first transform my email and then transform my Skype. And so if there's a little uncertainty going on here in my voice, it's because I'm not even sure I'm on the air. But I'm going to assume this is all working right, even though I can't find my little balloon that connects me to you. in the meanwhile, there's been so much activity around here. I'm glad to try to settle down with the best audience in the universe. It's just been an amazing day. In fact, I think I know just how I can find out if I'm on the air. Andrew, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes. I think that means we're on the air because I can't find in this new system here my little balloon button that tells me I'm on the air. But before I get and that allows me to communicate with PRN. But that notwithstanding, one of the things that today I was dealing with folks that was really not at all easy to deal with, and this is a group of people that will understand that. I've been asked by the media to comment on one of the most desperately bizarre and sick abuse situations that that we've seen around the world in terms of within a family. There's this a couple out in California who have had 13 children, it looks like, and ages 2 to 29, and they have kept them all in captivity. All of them in captivity under the guise of his running a private school and homeschooling, which, believe me, folks, has nothing to do with homeschooling in the United States, which is actually a marvelous institution. These people have kept their children chained up. They've tortured their children. God knows what. When a 13-year-old escaped and actually had a non-working phone, which nonetheless worked for 911, and brought the police in, the 29-year-old, I think, was shackled. I'm not sure which one, but I think the 29-year-old, and looked like a 10-year-old. So we're looking at a bizarre situation. There's very little general information about it. But it does make you think, well, how do we even look at this other than that it's evil, that it's how do we really look at this? The little bit of information we have on background is that the woman who bore all these children was 16 years old when she married the 8-year older young man, and that God, it's actually hard to even look at this. And that she, my guess is that she was just taken over by this man in this tremendously abusive cult-like situation with his own children. The one of the kids actually returned to this. So how in the world do we explain that this thing has continued to exist? Never mind the hints we'll find out later that people ignored and so on. Well, you know, human beings, we were built for family life. We were built to grow up in families. We were built to learn from our parents. We were built to learn about the world from our parents, and to grow up thinking that the information we had from within our family was then applied to the world, and we gradually learned where it did, it didn't over the years. But this man cut off his children from any contact and basically made slaves of them. We don't know what kind of sexual issues may have been involved, but the big, big obvious issue is power. This was a Hitler in his own home. This was a cult leader with his own children. This is patriarchy at its extreme for the abuse of power over other people. And what he would have left people with is what I describe, you know, in my Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety book. It's an overwhelming set of negative emotions, of legacy emotions from abuse that would make these people unable to leave, unable to function. They're suffering from, in addition to the psychologically overwhelming experience that would make them feel so much guilt, shame, and anxiety that they would be submissive and obedient, but also extreme failure to thrive, in which they didn't even develop normal functioning. And, you know, I just hope that there is hope for most of these folks, or all of them, to have some kind of recovery. But it's going to be an extreme situation. Think of this as the extreme of the male abuse of the family, the extreme of patriarchy, the extreme of all authoritarianism. And I'm sure we're going to find out that this wife, however much she cooperated, was herself some form of a slave. It's hard to believe that wouldn't be the case. And this man actually went to work, so she must have been cooperating in some way. But you know, all of this we'll be learning about. But it's going to be a study. It's going to be a study in abuse. So let me switch to what is going to be a very, 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 very positive hour. Thank God for that. And Andrew, I already know you're there. My guest is Andrew Sercum. His last name is spelled S-E-R-C-O-M-B-E. Andrew Sercum, S-E-R-C-O-M-B-E. And you'll find him through Power Change. powerchange@gmail.com, and you'll find his website through that. This is one of my ginger finds. We had never talked, although Andrew just told me when we began chatting before the show that he had a signed copy of Toxic Psychiatry mailed to him, I guess, many years ago. Maybe he can tell us more about that. What I find interesting is a number of different things, but Andrew is doing something that he calls therapeutic coaching. Those of you who know me and have listened to the show would say, you know, Peter, that sounds like something you've been promoting for a long time, because I, for a long time, have been saying we need to get out of the PhD, MD, psychiatric approach to helping people. It's just not feasible. It's usually off track. It's too dogmatic. We need a lot of variety, and we need lower cost approaches. Now, Andrew, I think he's a businessman, and I don't think that his fees are going to be lower cost, but I think the direction he's going in and the way he's training people and will be, and maybe he can give us some feedback on that. He taught for 15 years. He was a pastor for 15 years, and he's been doing training as an individual and as a business for a long time. His most recent book, or the one he'd like us to know about, which I have not seen, maybe he'll send me a copy, maybe I'll have Ginger get me a copy, is 52 Weeks to a Better Life, self-coaching handbook, a self-coaching handbook,
Peter,
52 weeks.
It's a self-leadership handbook.
Self-leadership. Boy, that's my handwriting. It's been such a hectic day. So, Andrew, I'm going to unleash you and just let you talk for a while, because I just think you're going to be a really interesting person. And talk about, take off from wherever you want with all of this.
Okay. I think the place to start is to say that I'm very English, so I hope my English accent works really well on your show, Peter.
It's a very impressive, and people are very used to it. I think one out of three or four of my guests is from Great Britain. So, yes, and we're always impressed here in the U.S. with British accents, so enjoy yourself, relax.
Thank you very much. Yes, just to give a little bit of history maybe to how I began doing what I'm doing. Having spent 10 years teaching, I used to teach design technology, which has got nothing to do with coaching, except I loved working with children. I loved the connection with people. And I moved from there into pastoring a church. And over here in the UK, we need to add usually don't hold that against me, because anything that's got a hint of religion over here is regarded very often as a bit persona non grata kind of thing. So that's a UK thing, I guess, maybe European. And having done that for 15 years, it became clear that I needed to move away from that voluntary sector stuff into a business context. And I thought to myself, how does an ex-institutionalized pastor begin at the age of 47 to reprogram not just his brain but his life? And I decided that I would take the gifts and talents that I had, which was pastoring, teaching, those kind of interpreting things easily into people's lives, and move into a business context. I'd always wanted to develop a business. And I started doing training and development. I went and did some extensive NLP training with a company in London, other sorts of training all connected to this. I'd already done some counseling background stuff with regard to the stuff that we were doing in the church and pastoral care. Suddenly, I was in a different world, and I found that it was so personally transforming for me, and I also discovered in the practice sessions that we were doing and the training we were doing, I was very, very good at it. I thought, I can really do this, and you'll excuse my British arrogance. I looked at the man at the front and thought, I can do it better than you. And I took that and I started doing it with anybody and everybody, my family, my parents. I'm now 67, so I was in my late 40s then. And all of a sudden, I found myself with opportunities. I was invited to go on to a local radio station, and I did a phone-in for a year. I wrote a number of books at that time. One or two fairly significant ones that it was called 50 Ways to a Better Life. It went around the world. It was published in Portuguese and Arabic and published all over the world, Australia, you know, other places. So suddenly I realized that I did have something here that was on offer. And I also needed to process some of the damage in my own life from my own background, which was, you know, very therapeutic for me. And actually, I discovered I loved that process. So I ended up starting to coach people. And I well remember the first time I thought about doing training, because I was working with a woman who was a manager of a social work a process over here in the UK, a local government thing. And I'd worked with her very successfully for these sessions. And as she walked away, she turned around and came back across my drive to and said to me, how did you do that? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, you've just done in a 2-hour session what a counselor hasn't been able to do for me in the last 15 years. And that was a shock to me. However, with my new business hat on, I decided in my head, I'm very happy to show you, but you'll have to pay. And that's when I started doing training. And eventually I developed that into what was called the Gold Coach Training Course, Power Change Gold Course. And we ran that, a 24-day coach training program in London. So that's my background. And over the years, I've done a lot of work in London. I've had all sorts of people come through that training program, from doctors. I work very closely with a doctor at the moment who is a very good friend of mine, and she sends me clients if I need anything checked out medically. I think that's a lovely thing. You don't necessarily have to be highly qualified. In fact, even the word qualified, the word to qualify something means to narrow it down. And over here in the UK, people have started to try and narrow down the coaching profession. And I say, no, don't do that. I want parents coaching their children. I want children coaching their parents. I want school kids coaching their fellow school kids. You know, don't narrow down. So broaden out. And that brings greater liberty to everybody. So that's a little bit of the background of where I've come from.
Well, I think it's absolutely fascinating. And I think it's a direction that I think we just have to keep going in, developing new approaches, individual approaches, franchising the approaches so that we have people who do your kind of work or my kind of work or some combination. And now, are you're actually training people? Oh, by the way, folks, all of my anxieties are over. I sent my wife a little instant message saying, please come in. And she came into the studio office here, and she found me my instant messaging on my new my new format for Skyping. So I can now instant message, and I've gotten the message from 15 minutes ago that I'm on the air. Which I just was thinking, I just hope I am. I have not voluntarily before done the show without being in instant message contact with the engineer, but I have once or twice done it by phone when I didn't have any choice.
When you had that little worry a little bit earlier, one, I thought I might coach you through it. No, I'm just joking. And two, I went straight to my computer and I could hear you clearly on my computer, so I knew we were on air. So that was not a problem.
Oh, well, you should have given me that information.
Shouldn't I?
Yeah, you certainly should have. Maybe you wanted to torture me. You're supposed to be coaching me. That's positive. You're supposed to be giving me a good feeling. So
I'm very much into not so much coaching. I think I want to be real. You know, we have a very clear coaching model that we use called Coach. I've got another one called The Ring, by the way, which is 12 process coaching thing. But Coach stands for Connect Well. That's the C. O is Obsess on Outcome. The A is Accept Reality or Accept Perceived Limitations, to accept them to start with. The C is to Create Together, and the H is to Hand Back Responsibility. So when I'm coaching somebody, I have that simple five-step coach model in my head. And the way I coach is I take a two-hour session every time. I don't do anything with a client for less than 2 hours. And I usually do four sessions over the course of 2 months, usually, something like that. So they get 8 hours, or if they need more, then I just simply add that in as part of the package. So that's what I'm doing. Every time I sit down with something, somebody connect well, obsess on outcome. What do you really want here? And it's not necessarily what they say they want, by the way. It's almost never what they say they want. Accept limitations. You know, if you've got somebody who is 65 and they want to become a doctor from having been some sort of other worker, an engineer, say, you know, that's not going to be a success. Nobody's going to take them on to train them and do all those things. You know, that's a reality. create together. That's where the magic happens, and hand back the responsibility. I love the fact that my clients leave my office and I'm no longer responsible for what they do with what we discuss together. So
could you give an example, or make up an example if that's more comfortable, or of maybe a few of how that interaction would go, and what might be discovered in the first few hours about what somebody really wanted? I mean, that's a question that I directly ask people often. What is it you really want? What do you really want? How do you imagine your life? Where would you like to take it?
And the question I ask, and it comes out not of NASA, but we call it DASA, D-A-S-A. You'll soon find out that I love these little five or six letters that you can just add together and make work, because people can remember them and they can stick in people's minds. And DASA stands for decide what you want, act towards it, see what happens, and adjust. And decide what you want is we use the first question is simply, what do you want? On my client record sheets, the first question you ask anybody is, what do you want? And most people have never been asked that question. And people will say, I don't know what I want. I've never stopped to think about it before. I'm not really sure. I want to be happy, you see. And as I say to people, when they say, I want to be happy, you say, well, that happiness is a spin-off from doing other things. Happiness is what you've discovered within yourself when you're doing what you want. So let's find out what you want to do, or what you're enjoying what you're doing. But following the question, what do you want, and their answer, we ask this next question, which is the big one, and it's, what will that give you? Because although people will say, I want to earn lots of money, when you say, what will that give you, they have to go to a deeper level. And one of the things we've learned over the years, well, for me personally, is I don't do shallow. So I'm not really interested in just a quick fix. I'm looking at what is really below the surface. I have very little to offer above ground level. I'm looking at what is at the root of all this. Where does this tree root tap into? What is actually it feasting on? What is going to bring satisfaction to this person at a deeper level? So I'm asking that question, what will that give you? And then you can go on to be very specific in terms of identifying that outcome and obsessing on it. Because if you aim at nothing, you'll hit it every time. So what we're looking for is people who, first of all, don't know where they're going, because that time and again, that is one reason why they have come to me, is because they cannot see a future. They cannot see a hopeful, attainable, interesting pathway ahead. You know, we say the three big killers in our therapeutic coaching are hopelessness, helplessness, and worthlessness. And so we deal with the worthlessness. We have a very simple program that does that in about an hour, where people will never again say that they feel worthless. They won't go there. They just don't. So the worthlessness is dealt with. The helplessness is dealt with, because once people understand that they do have resources, they do have power, they do have access. We run a program called Fields of Strength, which shows that even if you are weak, there are ways of getting strong, and you have those ways available to you now. But once you've dealt with those, the hopelessness goes. People can see, and you can literally see it when you're coaching them. You can see their eyes light up. The conversation goes quiet. Suddenly they hold their head up. Their body language starts indicating something different. And it's a very exciting place to be when you're coaching therapeutically with people like that. So that would be one example. People will say, I just want to get on with my boyfriend. And again, you see, you ask, and what will that give you? You know? And so there's always that deeper, taking it deeper. You can go many levels deeper, because when they say, I will do this, you can ask that, you can say, what will that give you? You know, when you've got that, what will that give you? So you can take it quite deep. But it's the what it'll give you is going to be more revealing in terms of that questioning. I mean, I've had so many people say to me, I remember, because I've done so many demonstrations of coaching in front of groups of people, one-on-one, but with a group of people watching. And time and again, people say, Andrew, how did you get to that in just three questions? How did you get there in just three questions? And again, it's to start with, I have this deep-seated conviction that this person will change. So, you know, again, it's that, I jokingly say, but it's not really a joke, because if you spend 2 hours with me, you'll never be the same person ever again. And I did that today with a lad, somebody who's just lost his job. He's 21. He's never been out of work. He was worried sick. He came to see me. We had lunch together. And during that course of lunch, we asked him some of these questions. And his eyes lit up as he realized that he could think differently. It was possible to re-mean his life. I enjoy creating words, and re-meaning is one of them. You know, we have a meaning that we think works, but re-meaning is about changing that meaning, because, of course, human beings are the only creatures in the universe that we know that create meaning about things. And when we realize that we can create meaning, this morning I spent some time with a person who has been charged with an abuse situation, for which I am absolutely convinced he's not guilty. I know him well. It's not the way he operates. And of course, what happens is you're standing in court. You will have known, you've seen this happen endless times because you've been in court so many times. The fear, the shock, the fear, the anxiety that goes with that is massive. And I said to him, no, this is just an adventure. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, in 10 years' time, you look back on this and you'll just simply be so grateful for it, because it'll have given you so much more understanding and learning that you didn't have before. Again, changing the meaning, altering the meaning. And, of course, that's the root of what we call auto-response psychology. When you've changed the meaning, a person will respond in their lives very differently, provided that meaning is taken on board at a very deep beliefs level. So I'm very good at talking for a very long time, Peter. You need to ask me another question.
Well, I'm absorbing. Do you go much into what more traditional therapies? Well, I don't know if it's even traditional, but like what I do and what I know a lot of other people do, which is look at, where did you get that self-destructive idea? Where did you get that hopelessness or helplessness? Or where did you get the idea you had to be perfect? Or do you go into looking at childhood?
Yes, I tend to ask the question, oh, really? So how old were you when you decided that?
Good. And that's interesting. Mm-hmm.
And the reason I ask that question in that way is because it's loaded with assumptions. First of all, you decided that you weren't born with it. There was an age when you decided that. There was a time and place when you decided that. How old were you when you decided that? And that time and place will be specific. And those people will say something like, I've always thought it. And I say, oh, no. You weren't born with it. You know, little children aren't born with that sort of belief. They don't even know the words. So how old were you when you picked up that belief? And I will refer to it as a belief, not a truth. And they will say, well, when I was so-and-so. And I'll say, oh, right, okay, so maybe we'll look at that sometime or whatever. And we've got several little clever exercises that empower the person. And in their thinking, as they run through their life from day, I say to people, no, I don't look at the past. I only look at the future from the day you were born.
go ahead. This is all very interesting to me. And I think it has a lot to do with charisma, I think, with your own charisma, with your own ability to give hope and give courage, give encouragement. When you're training, you actually train people in doing this work, I gather.
Yeah, we have got people, you know, you mentioned franchising just now. I have franchised Power Change. You know, I have got Power Change coaches in London, Warwick, South Wales, different parts of the UK, people who have paid me to use the brand name and use our materials and tools, and do so very well.
How does it work to try to communicate to people your enthusiastic nature, your ability to inspire? Is there any way to do that, or do you? What do you do about that?
Spend some time with me. You know, I think so much of this is actually to do with it's caught as well as taught. That's one reason why we did the 24-day coach training program, which is 1 or 2 days a month, or it was then. I mean, I've stopped doing it because I just found it was demanding too much of my time and life. But I ran it for 10 years. And the reason we did that 24 days, 2 days a month means, well, to be honest, after 2 days of intensive training, you're not taking anything else in anyway. So we just give people a month to come back and do another 2 days the next month. So they're training over a period of a year. And during that time, we've got all sorts of other things in book lists, practice sessions with their friends and people. But we also say you'll be coaching from the very first weekend. Because we will give you tools that will help change the lives of people by asking questions that don't necessarily need answers. And people say, what do you mean you don't need answers? So I don't need to hear the answer for your life to start changing. So, for instance, I have something called Questions That Change Your Mind. And I've got a sheet of it here in front of me. It just happens to be on my desk because, as you know, I had to move venue in order to be able to talk to you. For instance, here's a question: with whom am I not being real? And another question: what are my false assumptions? Or another question: to whom do I need to show mercy? Or what effect has anger had on me? Now, that's a very, very interesting question, because I have these in a pack of cards called Questions That Change Your Mind, and the downloadable from Trainer's Box, by the way, but trainersbox.net. And we actually set this up, and we said I was going to get some stuff published. Went to see a couple who were going to do some of the publishing, and as I walked in my normal blasé style, I hooked this pack of cards out of my pocket, as I do, fanned them out, question side down, and said, pick a card, any card, you know, just as you would do, you know, pick a card, any card, as a conjurer would do. And this guy picked the card, and I said, and the question is, and he said, how has anger affected me? Or whatever that question was. And instead, just there, what is it? What effect has anger had on me? And he said, I'm not angry. And I said, the card doesn't say you're anger. And he looked at me with, and his face went white, and he said, my mother. And he then proceeded to describe how his mother's anger had profoundly affected his life. And then went on to tell me that him and his wife had split up the previous 3 days. He'd spent 2 days away, not expecting to be back with her. They'd only come back because they were both directors of this company and they were coming back to see me. And at that moment, his whole world changed. He didn't move out at all. He moved back in that day. His life changed. And his wife sent me a testimonial that reads, Andrew Circum changed my, saved my marriage in 5 minutes. And that's exactly true. That's exactly what happened. But again, you see, it's to do with that faith. You know, I say to the coaches, people's lives won't change because they believe they will. People's lives will change because you believe they will. And they catch that faith and they start to believe you because you're the professional. And that's how it works for me. People come to me and people's lives change because I believe they will. which is an upside down way of a lot of people approaching it. You know, people say, oh, well, you know, according to your faith be unto you, which of course is true. You know, one of my heroes said that. But it's more than that. According to my faith, those people will change. And I have a lot of faith for people. And that's one reason why I was very attracted to some of your stuff, because, you know, we don't need these neurotoxins going into people's lives. They don't need it. We don't need it. We don't need it as a society. It's crippling us as people. It's crippling our society. It's doing so much damage. So for me, it's to do with my faith, which is one reason why I don't take on too many clients over the course of a month, because I need to be doing things in my own life that will refresh, empower, strengthen, and deepen me as a person. When I'm mentoring clients, that's the same sort of approach that I take. I've talked. I'm good at talking. Ask me.
I'm doing great. I'm good at interrupting. Don't worry about that at all.
Okay.
You know, I'm glad that you brought up my work, because I was so caught up in the horror of this California story, which I began the show with, folks who just tuned in. The story of this man and woman who kept their children ages 2 to 29 enslaved in their own home. And it's all over the news. And I talked about what I thought about it, because I didn't. And you used the word neurotoxin, and that cued me in to that you had read my writing, of course. And today I put up a new blog, and people can get to it by going to the website, Bregan.com, and just going to my frequent alerts, and that will take you right to the new blog. And it's one of the most important I've ever written, I think. It really captures for me how to go about finally talking about psychiatric drugs in a way that requires honesty. So I'm going to come right back now to Andrew Sercombe, because I think that I don't want to interrupt this flow, but it did remind me that I hadn't mentioned today at the intro, like I usually would, that I do have a new blog up. And it's I think it hits to the heart of how to talk to people about psychiatric drugs in a new and better and stronger and incontrovertible way. So look at me. I'm using stronger language than I usually would, and I'm inspired by my guest to do so. Andrew, with this example you gave, which, you know, any of us who do therapy are familiar with, of the man who has this insight of his response to his mother's anger, and you get to it very quickly and get to the heart of it. Do you follow up with him? Are there more discussions with him about that? How do you go about your work?
Yeah, well, him and his wife joined my next Power Change training course.
Okay. So that's
they were
the
just
follow-up.
Overwhelmed with this. And sadly, his wife died last year. And I went to the funeral. And Peter, you would not believe, at the funeral, in his speech about his wife, and he talked for about half an hour, I should think, 10 minutes of that was talking about Power Change, you know, my company, and thanking God for his interaction with Power Change. And that day he described that meeting, he described what happened, and he said, my wife that day took off in terms of coaching. She grabbed this. She was killed she died in a car accident. So it was a very sad moment. But for him, he just said she was absolutely obsessed with coaching. She took this and she ran with it. And he said, on the street, in a waiting room, anywhere, she would start to a restaurant, she would start coaching people wherever she was. And that's true for me too. I'm totally hooked. I have an addiction to coaching, I'm afraid. And watch it change people's lives. But I couldn't believe I sat at the back of this service in a church, and he was just praising coaching Power Change.
Yeah. It must have been very, very, very satisfying to you, I can imagine.
Well, I think what happens is it just shows that these things can profoundly alter, because it is to do with the meaning and beliefs. Who was it? It was Robert Diltz. I don't know whether you've come across Robert Diltz. He's an NLP guy, and he's very, very good. Again, somebody who I trust my life to. He's very reliable, very good man, full of integrity, which cannot always be said about NLP people, by the way. But and he has a book called Changing Beliefs with NLP, and we've taken some of his stuff and developed it further, and that's what we tend to do with everything. We've come across particular things that work. We look at them and you say, is this really working? Does this work the way we want it to, you know? And does it work for us? And sometimes, well, usually we develop it over the next 6 months and make it work better. But he talks about beliefs. Well, of course, our lives, we love truth. As human beings, we feel very, very safe with truth. I think you were talking to Tony Stanton last time about making people feel safe. Oh, I know. It was Tony Stanton's talked about safety, predictability, and engagement as three key human needs. And people feel safe with truth. Even if it's bad truth, they'd rather know the truth. That's what they'll tell you. Because truth feels like a solid foundation. But much of the truth, quote truth, that people believe is just a belief. It's not actually truth. And so I'll talk about truth to a client. They'll say, oh, well, the thing is, I'm rubbish. And I'll say, do you like people who tell lies? And they say, no, looking at you, wondering where you're going. And you say, well, it's not surprising that you don't like yourself then. And they'll say, what do you mean? And I say, well, you tell lies about yourself all the time. And they say, what do you mean? And I say, well, for instance, you've just said you're rubbish, and you're not rubbish, are you? You're all sorts of things that aren't rubbish about you. So you just describe yourself as rubbish. Now, if you're listening to yourself say those things, you'll eventually stop trusting yourself, and your sense of confidence will drop. So let's take a look at the truth. And I also, with success, you know, America is dominated by a passion for success. And my definition of success is the inevitable result of being human. You cannot help but be successful. And people say, what do you mean? I say, well, just stop and think how successful you've been today. You woke up successfully. You had your breakfast successfully. You got dressed successfully. You talked to me successfully. You got to my appointment, your appointment with me successfully. You've driven your car successfully. How many more successes do you want in a day? You know, you are a successful person. And sometimes you'll find people who deliberately sabotage themselves, and I'll say, even that's a success. And they say, what do you mean? I said, well, you're doing everything possible to avoid having to do this. And you've been really successful at it. You've never once done it. It's like the word can't. You know, when somebody says to me, I can't do that. And I'll say, let me just tell you what I hear when somebody says the word can't. I can not do it. And I can not do it really successfully. In fact, I've been so successful at not doing it that I've never ever done it. So what would happen if you did? What would happen if one day you did do it? What would be the result of that? Now, you can see how that, again, is all bound up with integrity, trust, self-trust, trustworthiness. I bang on about trustworthiness. So you don't need to say, trust me, trust me, trust me. You just need to be trustworthy. And people will start to trust you straight away. But being trustworthy is a long-term strategy, whereas trusting you is a short-term strategy. You need to prove that you are trustworthy when people trust you. So, you know, there's all those things wrapped up. I'm just rabbiting on about some of the things that are important to me in my coaching practice and working with people.
What kind of answers do you get when you ask people, you know, what's going to happen if you did do that?
Oh, usually silence. Because, and of course, silence is so telling. I love silence in a conversation, because what it means is that person's brain is starting to reprogram itself, because they haven't been able to go down the normal neurological motorway that they've always gone down to answer that question. They don't have an answer. And that's when you move to the C of the COACH, which is create together. so we can start saying, so what would happen if you did do that? How? Oh, and eventually you get to, oh, my mum would freak out. Or the thing is, if I did that, I'd have to get up every morning. Or so it goes on. And I say, so right, so what we're actually looking at is these other things. It's not that you can't actually do it. It's that the motivation's not there to do it. So I have got a very quick answer to that one. I'll say, if I paid you £20,000 for the first answer that you give to the reason of what would happen if you did do it, what would your first answer be? I said, well, you can make £100,000 in the next 5 minutes by coming up with five answers that will remotivate the way you think. And what you're doing, of course, what I'm doing at that time is I'm breaking through the, oh, there's nothing that I can do. I can't have any answers. I don't know the way forward. That sort of bleak hopelessness. We're invading the impossible here, or the perception of the impossible. And the coaching, the therapeutic coaching, is a deliberate way of invading that and breaking that cycle. I create trauma in my coaching. One of the things I say to people, and I've had people shocked by saying, what do you mean you create trauma? And I say, well, think of how amazing trauma is. Trauma is one of these things that profoundly alters the whole way a person thinks and experiences the world. Usually we perceive it in a negative sense. But what would it be like if we created massively good trauma in a person's brain? All of a sudden, their personality will change for the better. All of a sudden, their thinking will alter. All of a sudden, this trauma, which, as you know, is about visual, auditory, kinesthetic, olfactory, gustatory, gestalt, all happening in a split second. You know, as we deal with that, all of a sudden, we're creating good trauma. And it's like winning the lottery. Winning the lottery is what people perceive as a good trauma. But creating good trauma in a therapeutic sense is hugely beneficial to a client. And, of course, it deals with the whole, you'll need to be coached for the next 2 years for this. You know, I was speaking to another psychiatrist from the States this week, and she said, you know, when somebody says to me, how long will this counseling take, she says, I say to them, it takes as long as it takes. And of course, I don't say that because what will happen is it'll go on and on and on and on, which does nothing but benefit the coach or the counselor because you continue to get paid for it. But if you're charging enough and you're charging properly, you don't need to do that. So I will say, oh, no, you'll be a different person after four sessions. That's 8 hours. And if you're not quite, then we'll give you one more free at the end of it. So all you'll need is 10 hours of coaching, and you'll never be the same person again. This will be dealt with. And
do you have any follow-up study, any way to confirm your sense of how lasting these things are?
Lasting? Oh, yeah. People come back to me 10 years later, 5 years later, 7 years later, 2 years later, and say, Andrew, I just want to say, first of all, thank you. Seeing you was just an amazing time. I have a file that I call a well done file because I think it's very good to be able to package that. It was the difference, too, between pastoring, which is a kind of never ending process, and coaching, which has got a clear beginning and a clear end. You come to me for these things. This is your takeaway. This is what you're going away with. How is that working out into your life? And with auto-response psychology, we have an embedding process, which we've also included it into what we call the Ring training program, which you can also, people can download the Ring from trainersbox.net, which is a company that it takes on marketing my stuff. But the embedding is, we use a simple five-star process for embedding change into their brain. But it's a bit like their brain cannot work the same way. You know, if a person's been driving around in an old banger of a car and somebody offers them a really beautiful, nice car, and you park both of them outside their door and you say, which one are you going to drive today? They won't go to the old banger. they will always go to the better option. And so if we're creating a better option, they won't actually go to the worse option, which is where they've been in the past. I think that's also one reason why it's important to charge realistically. I have two rules on money. The first one is all money is paid up front. And the second one is I don't give any money back. So when a client comes into my office, they are already, they've already paid for all the sessions, the package, and they're not going to get any money back. So their motivation to pay attention and embed and do what they paid for is very high. And my reputation hangs on it as well, of course. So you know, there's that element which is important. I want my next client. Because most of my work can these days.
Really, it's really an interesting model, because I can easily see how the working with people with insurance who are not making a huge sacrifice to pay to come and who've never invested in it. I've never worked with a client in that manner that you are. I mean, I can really see the big advantages you would have. It limits in a lot of different ways the people you can see, but that doesn't have to be your problem. I can see how very much that this would make for a high incentive situation. How do you think, and I know you get some, you said you can't get referrals because you're not an official guy in England, but people are sometimes encouraged to see you by their doctors, their physicians. Are most of the people you're seeing relatively high functioning when they get to you? If they have that much money and that much confidence in their own judgment and going to you, they're probably pretty high functioning, or is that a misimpression?
Coaching is different in one sense to working as a therapist with mentally ill people. And I understand that, but I would say the majority of people who come to me do have medium, very often medium-term depression. But you see, my view is depression is something that you do, not something that you have. I don't see depression as, I look at a person and I say, well, honestly, if I had your background, I'd be depressed too. Let's do something about this, you know, because I look at causes, not symptoms. But I say to people, you know, I've done depression twice in my life. Once when I had a fractured skull when I was 20, and two, when I had a quite serious burnout, breakdowny burnout when I was 40. And what I say is, I did depression and I didn't enjoy it very much, so I don't do it anymore. Now, what you're doing at that point is you're showing a person that depression is something that you can change and you can have control of. Now, that is completely foreign to the beliefs of many people in the medical profession, not least for all the reasons that you would say, and I would agree with you, of course, in terms of psychiatric medication. You know, if a person can change their behavior and change the causes of their behavior so that their behavior changes, they won't need medication. Now, that's not good news for the drugs companies. So anything that would imply that depression is controllable is going to cause problems. I use something called, I call it SGM. And people say, what's SGM? I said, self-generated medication. And they say, what do you mean, self-generated medication? And I say, well, your brain, your body, is a massive chemical factory. But everybody knows that. And if you need more of one sort of therapeutic drug or another, we can create that in your body. So your body is developing more of that product rather than adding it in from outside, because when your body notices it's being added in from outside, it'll just reduce its own production factory even more so. So your body is a factory of all the drugs that you ever need, pretty much, in this particular way. Unless we can do a blood test and we can see that your body is lacking in one particular drug, which we will add in, then we won't be doing that. And of course, in terms of psychiatric medication, that's impossible to attain. So let's just see what we can do to generate, get your body to generate for itself the drugs that you need.
I love that metaphor, actually. It reminds me of the nutritional approach, the sound nutritional approach, which is that if you eat properly, which from the viewpoint of the nutritionist I work with is a plant-based, low-fat, no-dairy eating, basic foods, basic plants,
yep.
And very little animal. You can have some, but very little animal. You don't need any supplements. Your body will make what you need. That the supplements are very much like the psychiatric drugs. They're these exogenous things that you're going to put in your body to try to change it, rather than living right and eating right, which is what gives us good lives.
Exactly.
We've got 2 minutes left. Folks, I'm talking with Andrew Circum, and he's an amazing man. It's a day that I would be fun to take questions, but one of the reasons I don't take questions is they're almost always about psychiatric drugs. And Andrew spells his last name Sercombe. He's from Great Britain. He's got his own business. And a power change is his trademarked concept. Andrew, do you directly discuss psychiatric drugs if your patients come to your clients, with your folks, your people come
to
you? What do you call your folks?
Clients.
If your clients come
to
you on psych meds,
under
do
any
you address that? Do you address it, their being on psych meds? You must.
Yes, I do. And one of the first questions I ask is, are you on any relevant medication? And some people will say, I'm on the pill. And I say, that's not a relevant medication necessarily. I want to know, are you on any therapeutic medication? I'll give them some examples. But I don't. I do have, in discussion with my GP friend, I do two things. The first one is, I say, right, we will address the causes. Because if we can address the causes of your sadness, I call it persistent unhappiness. If we address the causes of your persistent unhappiness, you won't need medication at all at any point. So,
Andrew,
and then we can take you off.
Andrew, I got to end. The music has started. It's a good ending. You're at a good place. Thank you. Thank you a lot for being on the show. It's been invigorating for me and thought-provoking, and I hope my folks have very much enjoyed it. Thank you a lot for being on.
You're welcome. It's been lovely to be with you.
Okay, bye-bye now, and
bye-bye,
folks around the world. I hope you feel inspired.